good. This is another oral history interview conducted by the University Archives and Special Collections Unit. I'm Ralph Pugh, University Archivist. I'm co-conducting this interview with Adam Strome, Director of University Archives and Special Collections. And today, the 7th of March, 2017, we are interviewing soon-to-retire Vice President of Finance and Administration, Patricia Laughlin, whose last day, or official last day, will be the 1st of May of this year, 2017. So thank you very much for sitting down with us.
Thank you for the invitation.
The way we are evolving in terms of doing these interviews is to ask you to, for the record, start off with a few sentences about your final position, what you're doing.
Sure.
And then we'll go back to the start of your career.
Sure, no problem. So as the Vice President for Finance and Administration, I've been responsible for the financial aspects of the university, for some of the auxiliaries, for human resources. So it's a pretty broad-based position for the university, and then I've also held the CFO position for ITRI.
Okay.
Yeah, so if you think about anything financial, pretty much has gone through my office.
Good. All right. Quite broad. Okay, as I indicated before we started, you have ended up in that position, but obviously you worked toward that position in all sorts of intended and unintended ways.
Mm-hmm.
And so we want to take you back to Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
To your beginning in terms of your adulthood,
mm-hmm.
Your education, and what you started off with. We see that you were committed to the field of education early on. Yeah, give us your experiences and your ethos and what you wanted to do with your career, what was intended, what was unintended.
Mm-hmm.
Start with Pittsburgh.
Sure, great. I never thought that I was going to have a career in higher ed administration. That really wasn't what I started out thinking I would be doing, and it evolved. So
mm-hmm.
I was fortunate in being able to get positions along the way. I realized that higher ed was very, very interesting and challenging.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, I was at the University of Pittsburgh,
mm-hmm.
and I was pursuing my bachelor's degree after having graduated from a community college. So I'm mm-hmm. one of those
mm-hmm.
grassroots individuals,
mm-hmm.
working class family, first one in the family to, first female in the family to go through and get a degree.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. My older brother also managed to get a degree, so we were sort of pioneers for the family.
Mm-hmm.
And I managed to get a position at the University of Pittsburgh in governmental relations.
Okay.
And I was doing pre-award research administration, meaning helping individual faculty match up with opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
And it was broad-based because it went from the arts to the medical fields,
mm-hmm.
engineering, science. So that's the way I started. And mm-hmm. I became a higher ed junkie.
Uh-huh.
It was tough to leave.
Uh-huh.
I had worked in private industry before that just for a very short period of time,
mm-hmm.
and I just found higher ed to be unlimited opportunities, both in my education and mm-hmm. in my career.
The various interfaces that that affords. And
absolutely.
It seems like you've certainly done a number of them.
Mm-hmm.
Are you a native of Pennsylvania?
Absolutely.
Share that with Adam.
Mount yeah. Washington.
Oh, I was born at McGee Women's and spent the early part of my life in Manor.
Okay, I know where Manor is.
Yep.
Yeah. If you've ever been to Pittsburgh and you see all of those wonderful photos of the crest of the hill looking down at the center city,
mm-hmm.
that's where I lived, about eight houses down from the front of that hillside.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I come from a working class background as well. And the first to achieve various sorts of things in terms of college. And yeah, it informs who you are. And I don't know whether it's fair to say you can say yes or no, but you're not quite sure because you have no role models from your previous generations about higher ed and whatnot.
That's exactly
so,
right.
So it's both rather challenging, but in another way, very liberating. They'll just simply say, well, whatever you want to do, go ahead and do it.
Yes.
And so your folks were supportive that way.
Well, actually, I have a funny story about my father. So my first semester at community college, I worked full-time and went to school full-time
okay.
for a number of years.
Mm-hmm.
And my first semester, I just decided it was far too much responsibility and that I was going to give one or the other up. And since I needed to support myself, it was going to be the school.
All right.
And in those days, the grades came home to the parents. And my father got my grades, and he saw a 4.0. Hmm. And he was just bouncing off the walls and the ceiling, beaming, so proud of me. And I didn't have the heart to tell him I wasn't going back for the second semester. So there are those wonderful moments when you realize that you need to take a different course.
Yeah, that's true.
Mm-hmm. And then I worked at the University of Pittsburgh for about 7 years, I think. Mm-hmm. And then I moved from there to Carnegie Mellon. Mm-hmm. And along the way, I also taught at Robert Morris University. There's a Robert Morris in Pittsburgh, not the one here in Chicago. Uh-huh. Okay. And I taught in a graduate program there. So my experience really runs pretty much on the private institution side. Mm-hmm. Pitt was, in those days, affiliated with the Commonwealth. So it sort of had a foot in each camp of being public and private. Mm-hmm. But I really appreciate the flexibility and freedom that we have to act in private higher ed. Mm-hmm. It's a lot different than it is in the public institutions.
It's true. It's true, yeah. For, again, good or ill, obviously you have to be more adroit in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so coming with the education background, but moving by 1980 into the engineering realm,
mm-hmm.
how did you manage that transition?
Serendipity.
Okay.
The assistant dean for the School of Engineering was open. It was the administrative dean position.
Okay.
I called up one of the few people that I knew at Carnegie Mellon and said, is this job wired? Because very often in those days, you had to post it, but there was an internal candidate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the individual said, no, as a matter of fact, it's wide open.
Mm.
In fact, I think you should apply, because one of the things that this dean is focused on is research administration, and you have that background.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I ended up interviewing for the job and getting the job. And then successively, I never intended to stay there that long, that's for sure.
28 years?
Yeah, 28 mm-hmm. years. I really believe in changing it up and getting new opportunities, but it was fascinating because I got to stay in one place in the engineering college, and everything changed around me rapidly.
All right.
And I had deans who came and went in less than 5 years.
Uh-huh.
5 years was actually a very long tenure for a dean of engineering, and it wasn't for bad reasons. They moved on to be provost, either at CMU or at another institution.
Uh-huh.
So it was a really rapid growth, rapid changing environment.
Uh-huh.
And as the deans changed over, I ended up taking on more and more responsibility. And I had the same type of responsibility as a CFO, it just was at the college level.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. So that very much worked in terms of being able to keep your base, your family base, and I imagine at that point you still have parents alive and whatnot that you could still get to and visit. And
work and family has always been really, really interesting, especially in mm-hmm. higher ed. When I had my first son 34 years ago now, very few women returned. Mm-hmm. So you took a maternity leave. And if everything went well, you usually stayed home.
Mm-hmm.
And there were very few role models for me of women who came back into the workforce.
Mm-hmm.
And that was an awful lot of pressure because I was in a very male-dominated environment, mm-hmm. engineering.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes in meetings, I was the only woman in the room.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it was somewhat odd sometimes to see another woman in the room because that reminded me how different it was from everyone else sitting around the table. And so work and family was always a big balance for me.
Yeah.
And I also knew that I was going to be the role model for the generation of women coming behind me. And so whatever I did, I knew I had to do it very, very well. And oftentimes I think I put more pressure on myself than the institution was putting on me to make sure that I was there, make sure that I was at the meetings, make sure that I was able to get to the daycare 2 minutes before it closed. But I was in good company. There were a lot of other folks who were very driven at the institution. And a lot of my male peers were the ones who were responsible for picking up their children at the daycare, which was on site. So, yeah, I mean, it it was an interesting time and a very rapidly changing time.
Yeah. You're, as we'll mention, our previous interviewee was Ruth Sweetser, who was sitting right there four days ago, who also was a leader in terms of female advancing in education and trying to coordinate that and bring her special commitment to continuing and not just simply having to terminate it at a certain point.
Absolutely.
Was there the added concern that people were expecting you to leave? At I've heard that from some women.
Yes.
That the expectation was, okay, you're not coming back, therefore other people are already trying to position themselves.
It wasn't so much other people positioning, but it was that real uncertainty. Will she come back? Yeah, she says she will, but we don't really trust that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
In the end, I think I had very supportive males. They were awkward at times in the way they were supportive, but they were really trying to be supportive from the heart.
Okay.
And so for me, that was what I needed to be able to continue.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Of course, Ruth Sweetser moved into the AUW and active that, using that as her vehicle to make sure that she could then mentor women in academia and, and other ancillary industries and routes. Have you also felt, I bet you have, that same sense of mission?
Yes.
If you want to elaborate on that,
definitely.
Please go ahead.
Definitely. We were trying desperately within the university and also at the K-12 level to find ways to support and encourage young women to study engineering, math and science, especially K-12. And so we had a number of initiatives related to outreach. We had initiatives on campus related to supporting women graduate students, programs, and we had a number of initiatives trying to get their male peers to understand that there was a difference between being a male engineering student and a female engineering student at that time relative to climate and culture. Not to the discipline, not to the studies necessarily, but the way that women, the challenges that women faced by often being the only one in the room, by sometimes having that responsibility of feeling that they internalized. So the successes were sort of opportunistic or chance sometimes, but the failures were so deeply internalized where their male peers might say, oh, that was just an unfair test, or, oh, I'll get it the next time, and just brush it off. And so they needed more support to reinforce the notion that this was the right fit. This was the right place for them. And that's the more subtle side. And it worries me that we haven't gone past some of that. Some of it's a little bit underground, and it's more often than not that you see female mentors or role models within your own discipline, but it's still in very small numbers. And for the longest time, as a nation, we pumped a lot of money into these initiatives, and yet the numbers still hovered in engineering around the 20 to 25% mark. Yet biology, above 50%. Other disciplines that you would think, what's going on there? So I'm not steeped in that right now. I've moved off on some of those kinds of initiatives since I've been at IIT. I wish I could have been more involved. But we have great leadership. We have Eunice Santos. We have the Dean of Engineering, Natasha DiPolo. I mean, there are just, we have a great provost now that's a role model. She's both an architect and an engineer. So it's a lot different now. But yet, I suspect some of those same confidence issues might exist for a lot of our female students.
You feel it's a challenge or a need for the university here to build more of the sort of student support networks and to really become more programmatic and scientific about supporting women students with these particular things that, like you say, you know they're internalizing and perhaps holding them back?
I think one.
Or is it just more making sure you have more examples to follow?
No, I think it's if it was easy, if we could point to one or two things, we would have solved this a long, long time ago.
Yeah.
It's history. It's culture.
Yeah.
It's a whole. It's our K through 12 education system. There are so many different places. Some of it's socioeconomic. And so there are lots and lots of places that you can point to. If I come from a family that has the ability to offer me spectacular summer extra programming to build my confidence in math and science from the time I'm in fifth grade, then I might have a very different advantaged position than if I come from a less advantage situation and never had those opportunities. And then where do I get my advice on what course my career should take, which means what do I study, what do I pay attention to in high school, in middle school, and then what do I choose in college?
Certainly.
I love the commercial that's out right now about Millie Dresselhaus. Have you seen the one where they said if Millie Dresselhaus was treated like a rock star, and she was the first woman who won the Medal of Science. If she was treated like a rock star, where would we be now in terms of encouraging young women? So you wonder about the role of media, entertainment. There are lots and lots of different factors. If this was easy, we would have solved
this
by now.
That's true.
But I do have a great deal of hope with the younger generation in that I think there's a lot more confidence on their male peers' view that their sisters and their friends can compete with them.
All right. So at least that awareness
is becoming
established.
It does.
So there's maybe something less ingrained at this point.
I'm hoping.
Yeah.
I'm absolutely hoping that that's true. That is going to help change things as much as anything else. And I see it with this group of young men who are having children, who want to be more involved in their... It's not a chore to be involved. They want to be. They want to, by and large, and I know these are stereotypes, so I apologize if anyone listens to this and says, oh, but I'm the exception to that. Okay, I'm apologizing to you right now. We're talking about in the main. You see a lot of forward progress in terms of sharing of responsibilities that traditionally were assigned by gender. And now that's not true anymore. And so I do see a lot of hope with this generation that just maybe for some of them this is really changing.
I see that as well in terms of my speaking with the students in adjunct teaching and whatnot. A lot of the men are feminists. They are definitely feminists.
And, that's an interesting word. It's gotten a bad rap lately.
Well, unfairly.
And my view of it is it's as much about choice. It's as much about supporting whatever decision another woman wants to make as anything else. And in that sense, it's hard for me to understand why feminism is getting a bad reputation.
Yeah, people have spun it that way. To my understanding, feminism is just basically humanism. But given the historical disadvantages, there needs to be conscious approaches to the inequities to move forward, but feminism is ultimately in humanism. But obviously its opponents characterize it otherwise.
So I started in higher ed pre-Title IX. And didn't even think about it. And I was often in classes where I was maybe one of one or two women. Even though I'm not an engineer, that was not my discipline, but it was really, really interesting because I credit my brothers with my success in being able to work in an engineering college and in an institution like CMU or IIT.
Okay.
Because I was constantly challenged on every level, and I gave as good as I got. And so, in some ways, I wasn't intimidated. And I think I also knew how to speak to the guys because I had three brothers.
Are you the only
No, I have one sister.
Okay.
I have one sister, and we are about as different as you can imagine.
All right.
And it's really interesting because in the time frame between when she became an adult and when I did, the world was literally changing. And the role of women was starting to change. And so she took that very traditional role of wanting to be what you could be for the most part. You could be an administrative assistant or secretary, you could be a nurse, or you could be a teacher. And
how many years older was she, or is she?
She's 8 years older than I am.
That's a difference.
And that was the big divide.
Right, right.
Yeah, okay. It really was.
Yeah.
And so it was really, really interesting where she's one of my best friends, but not necessarily the role model, because I didn't want any of those things.
Yeah.
I went off in a very different pathway.
Yeah. I have an older sister who is 9 years older, and very much. She was born in the late 40s. I was born in the late 50s. And, yeah, there were major changes by then. She very much wanted to fit into the traditional models and whatnot. So in terms of, those early years are fascinating. On any given day, what did you find more of a challenge, or what did you internalize as a challenge being female or being working class?
You know, it's really hard to say. How do you separate those factors?
Right.
Yeah.
How do you separate a whole host of factors? How do you separate the fact that I have Catholic guilt sometimes because I grew up and attended Catholic school for 12 years? And so I'm not the interesting thing is, it's important not to try, in my opinion, not to single out one factor. Because we can be sitting here and someone says something, and I can immediately think, oh my gosh, that's because I'm a woman. But my male peer who was sitting next to me also took offense at it, and it had nothing to do with gender. It just was a stupid comment. And so I used to call that walking off the feminist cliff. And I wasn't one to immediately ascribe gender as the first reason, or socioeconomic status as the first reason. Sometimes it was age. I also entered higher ed administration at a time when I was fairly young and female.
Okay,
so which one was it? Did it matter? Probably not.
Yeah,
it probably didn't matter in the end, because my responsibility was to prove that I could do the job that I was given to do.
In that sense, perhaps it's a luxury that you had multiple things that might have been at play.
You're probably right.
As opposed to coming from a comfortable background and obsessing about the one thing that you felt people would consider determinative about you.
Yeah, and I think I tried desperately not to be in a box. So if you were going to say that my box was being a female, then I was going to move over to the next box for you just to confuse you.
Of course, you know, here you can hop around any number of boxes you want to. We will follow.
You can't get to my age without having lots of different spaces in those boxes. I mean, it's too complicated. It would be a boring life if I could be so simplistic to tell you, here's the one defining characteristic.
But it would make our job interviewing you so much easier.
It would, wouldn't it? That's right. So I'm sorry, we're bouncing all around here.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Yeah, absolutely.
So you spent, two decades plus at Carnegie Mellon. And I'm sure the kind of landscape at that school changed pretty dramatically in the time that you were there.
It did.
And so what caused the move to Chicago? Was it your desire to kind of change things up, or?
That was part of it. I had decided that, I needed to move on at CMU, and I took on for 1 year an interim project, and, it was not engineering related at all. It was, related to, using theater as a way to address cultural issues, and worked with that program for a year, and then took a little bit of time off, and I got a call from John Anderson, who had been here at about, I think about 2 years at that point.
Okay.
And he said, I need somebody to look at how we're doing some things here. Would you be willing to come out as a consultant? And so I said, yes, I would. And then shortly thereafter, the position of CFO was open. And he asked if I'd be interested in it. And the fun thing about it was never going to be an easy job. Never. But this institution has so much potential. And it was so easy to see that. That it became a compelling challenge. First of all, I love urban campuses. If you notice, I've spent most of my time either as a student or as an employee of an urban campus. The mission is so critical and important to the city in which those campuses are located. And certainly the population of students that we are making an attempt to serve. And I do believe for the ones who come here, we serve very, very well. The connection to the Chicago public schools in many different ways, the connection to a charter school. And so for me, it was almost like the capstone experience. It was the opportunity to make a difference in a fairly short period of time. I was given a very targeted outline of what needed to be done, and to work with a team that I felt very comfortable with, because John and I had worked together at Carnegie Mellon. He had been the president. Then the next year, and he had gone on to Case Western. And then Alan Cram was a department head in material science at Carnegie Mellon, and he went on to RPI to be the dean. And so John had hired Alan, and I knew that that was the team. So hopefully we didn't try to constantly be touting the fact that we're going to do everything like CMU, but I think we felt comfortable working with one another.
With the personal connections and whatnot. So.
Well, it wasn't so much that as it was the shorthand. It was the understanding. And having been in engineering together, I understood both of them from the perspective of where they were coming from. That doesn't mean we always agree on everything. I want to make that clear. But I did understand that perspective. And so it was a shorthand, and it made it the learning curve of just trying to work together as a team much, much shorter.
Well, it's good for you to address that because obviously there has been kind of a critical mass of CMU people coming here, and you're the first person to speak on that directly. It's certainly a material factor in IIT's history over the last decade, and so you're the first one to sort of comment on what that brought. It wasn't necessarily an agenda. It was a mode of communication of some people who had already worked together and were able to hit the ground running with the challenges here.
But before John came to IIT, I actually knew about IIT. Because way back in my early days at CMU, there was another administrator who came to IIT, Mel Bernstein. And Mel Bernstein was also a metallurgical and material scientist. In the same department that Alan Cram was from. And Mel came and spent some time here. He's moved on to other institutions, so I knew about IIT from way back when. And I always thought it was an interesting place. And then my brother also talked about IIT in the same breath as Stanford and other places. I mean, it was very well known at one point in time. In the University of Pittsburgh program that he was in engineering. And so I actually knew about the institution, and I'd been to Chicago a few times. I thought it was a really interesting city. And every time I came back over the years for a conference or some other meeting, I just thought it was even better. And so it wasn't a tough sell. However, it was complicated. So one of the other things in my background is we have a 136-acre farm outside of Pittsburgh. So my husband stayed behind to tend to the farm and the land. So we've had a commuting relationship for almost 8 years.
Yeah.
And that's part of the reason why I'm done. I'm ready to go back.
Yeah. It's actually one of the questions I had queued up in my brain, which is, are you going back?
And yes.
So there you go.
Yes.
But this was great opportunities, like the last 8 to 10 years of your career. And you, did you pretty much know it was going to be here, or was this going to be, oh, 2-3 years, and maybe I'll do something else?
3 years. Okay. That's what I committed to.
Really? Okay.
John said, look, if you're coming here, I can't have you just come for a year.
Mm-hmm.
I need a 3-year commitment out of you.
All right.
I said, okay, 3 years.
Okay.
And then he said, how about 5? And here I am.
All right.
What did you find, so making the transition from Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh to Chicago and IIT, what struck you as the biggest differences when you made that transition?
The biggest difference is the point in time. So IIT has so many opportunities to grow and should be so well positioned, being the technical institution here in the city.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got an aging infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
Carnegie Mellon had dealt with that problem a few decades ago and was building buildings right and left.
Mm-hmm.
And that in the late 90s and into the 2000s. And so I just looked at the focus on interdisciplinary work, very familiar to me. The focus on engineering really being a major driver in terms of the research mission and the education mission, the leadership of the institution, but also having wonderful and unique other programs like architecture. Carnegie Mellon is a similar type of,
mm-hmm.
of environment. Trying to manage the whole student population so that there's a balance between graduates, undergraduates, international. A lot of those same kind of similarities, actually. And Chicago as a city reminds me a lot and feels very comfortable in the same way of Pittsburgh.
I have often told people that I view Chicago as just a really big Pittsburgh.
Yes. People are so nice, well-grounded, helpful for the most part. I just really enjoy that. And I can't imagine that being true in lots of other places that I've gone to, visited, or don't even have the desire to visit.
Mm-hmm.
This is a really nice institution in a nice city. And that was a draw.
Putting it in historical context, of course, we all lived through the financial collapse of 08 in various ways. That's quite a challenge on your plate, I assume, when you start here in 09. What were some of the immediate things that your position could do to help the university move through that period?
There wasn't a whole lot of downtime.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't a whole lot of room for the learning curve.
Mm-hmm.
When I came in the second quarter of FY10,
mm-hmm.
the budget still wasn't quite balanced yet.
Okay.
And it was still a deficit budget. And there were lots and lots and lots of administrative issues that were rather serious and needed to be attended to. So it was almost the crisis of the day. How many of them were you going to have, and how many fires were you going to need to put out? And one of the things that we really worked very hard on was to be much more systematic and get to a point where we were no longer in the firefighting unit, but we were a little more proactive and able to look out a little bit further. That's had its ups and downs. We've had some successes and some years that were not so successful. But overall, when the board asked that we would bring the budget into balance, and they gave us a 5-year period and we did it in 4, that was the target. That's what we were asked to do. And that was one of the reasons that John wanted a longer commitment out of whoever came in as CFO, was to put together a sustainable plan and to make sure that we actually were able to achieve that plan.
All right.
And along the way, lots and lots of challenges. There were so many external relationships that we had to repair because the feeling was that the university could not be trusted, that things had deteriorated so rapidly financially.
Specifically, which institutions or interfaces were the damaged ones?
The rating agencies.
Okay.
The financial institutions from whom we had to have basic services, access to capital, line of credit, those sorts of things.
Okay.
Right. And it affected not just IIT, but it was ITRI as well in those days. So we had some pretty interesting major issues to deal with. And the only thing that I could say in my first meetings with some of those organizations was, I don't expect you to trust me, but I expect you to monitor, watch, understand what I'm saying to you, and then evaluate at the end of the year and see if everything I've said is or is not accurate. Mm. Because that was the only way to really rebuild the trust with those institutions.
To lay it out on those conditions.
Yes, yes. Right. They didn't know me.
Mm-hmm.
They had no clue who I was or why I was even here.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them were on the edge of being almost hostile because they felt that they had been somewhat misled. Now, part of that was just the events of the collapse. And the collapse was just so massive anyway that we were somewhat in the same boat as everyone else. It's just our boat was a little more leaky.
Again, speaking of context and maybe going back to a bit of a broader overview, our understanding, or at least my understanding, of course, is the Lou Collins era from 1990 until 2007 was very much an era of expansion and moving forward and trying to really save the campus from its precarious situation in the early 1990s. And succeeded in many sorts of ways, obviously rebuilding the campus and whatnot. But the impression one gets from looking at that basic narrative is that the school had, even apart from what happened in 08, already kind of overstretched. Was that part of the challenge as well?
Absolutely. Okay. And I think that was part of the challenge with the financial institutions.
All right.
Was the realization that we had been very aggressive in those later Lou Collins years in trying to get some things done. And then the crash came, and there were lots of questions around liquidity and our ability to actually meet all of our obligations.
Of course, not unique to IIT. One reads of any number of schools and nonprofits that spent the period from the late 90s until 08 trying to reinvent themselves to get up to the next big level.
That's right.
And many compromise themselves.
Yeah. Well, and I can't discount the unique challenge that we have being on the south side of Chicago. I think that's also somewhat of a challenge, and I've heard that at one point in time the university even considered moving from this location, but made the decision to stick it out. The board was supportive of that decision. But it had real financial implications for the institution as well. And so that was a part of probably some of the building difficulty as well. And they de-emphasized the undergraduate program in President Collins' later days. And that was at the expense of the massive expansion and growth of the professional schools and the master's programs. We were also very fortunate that we had a visionary in Darsh Wasan, who was able to get out of out ahead of the curve on the international population. And so we had a very strong international population, not just in engineering and science, which had been going on for decades, but he had managed to expand it into other areas as well. And so we had the business school that had some participation with the Chinese cohorts and the law school to a certain extent. So that was also a very heady time, I think, in terms of the expansion of the master's programs. And I'm not so sure that we didn't cut ourselves too deeply in terms of the undergraduate population.
During that period. So. But still,
all and we're trying areas. To rebuild it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I mean, that's a focus now, mm-hmm. and it's right. a struggle.
Yeah.
The demographics aren't always with us. Mm-hmm. We still are in the south side of Chicago, mm-hmm. and I can't tell you how often I get texts or phone calls from my relatives saying, mm-hmm. "Are you mm-hmm. okay?" Mm-hmm. Because the lead of the national news was about Chicago, mm-hmm. and it wasn't good.
True. Mm-hmm.
And they know I live in the South Loop. Mm-hmm. As soon as they hear that word "South," mm-hmm. they get very, very concerned.
Yeah, yeah. But there were really no alternatives to move. Would have been hugely disruptive. And then the Daley administration, the second Daley administration, was very much wanting IIT to return to its glory days in terms of being a Southside institution. And with the 1960s, with the first Mayor Daley. It's one thing that was very interesting speaking with David Baker mm-hmm. about the importance of the Daley connection in downtown that had been lost in the 70s and 80s. It came back in the 90s, but it kind of comes with a price tag, as it were, mm-hmm. in terms of, well, this is where you're going to be.
Well, I just think once you make that decision, you don't look back and you deal with it.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
All I'm saying is it's a factor.
Right.
And when we talk about the impact of the financial collapse and what led up to the university's growth, I do think that's a factor, and it's just something we have to consider and remember.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And when you arrived, you were working with or for both IIT and ITRI,
mm-hmm.
and how hard was it to juggle those two balls, or did it feel very much like kind of doing the same thing for each kind of arm, or was it? Did you feel as though you were needing to kind of work in two different directions at once?
Well, ITRI is, as you know, a unique entity. Okay, it's an independent entity from the university. However, it's got a board of governors, and so I'm an officer of the board of governors, and I'm also officially their CFO. Okay, so. At the time, ITRI was also involved in some financial transactions, and their research had dropped drastically because when the collapse came, a lot of industrial research just went away.
Mm-hmm.
Companies retrenched, some of them just didn't even make it, and they didn't invest in the types of research that ITRI was involved in. So a lot of their work shifted to government support. And I think if you talk to Dave McCormick, and that's another person you should talk to, actually. But if you talk to Dave McCormick, he would say that they're very strong if they have about a 50-50 mix. And before the collapse, it had tilted very, very strongly in the direction of private support. And then shortly after, they started being very successful with government grants, but their total volume had dropped, so the government piece of it was growing, but it wasn't providing the same base of support. And then lo and behold, they needed to do some, they needed access to the capital markets and to do some things financially. So in some ways, it was really interesting because the financial institutions don't always make a definitive split between the university and ITRI.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was actually helpful to be in some of those meetings and being able to address with authority both institutions. But again, it was a process of building some trust because they weren't going to trust me just walking in the door.
Yeah.
They just didn't feel the again, that the institution was necessarily always reporting appropriately to them. And so we turned that around, and we made a big difference there. But it was very painful. On the day-to-day operations side, though, Dave McCormick and his crew run the institution. It's really just the governing piece mm-hmm. of it that I get involved in.
I wonder if we can just kind of take a brief off
sure.
onto ITRI a bit more.
Yeah.
Because I think it's an area in its relation with IIT that a lot of people don't understand. I'm going to ask you to maybe give us a bit of a history say from 1990 onward. I know that's, you know, goes back before your time, but I'm sure you're up to speed on that. Because I understand a large part of the spinoff between the two, or separation between the two, occurred in late 2001. What was the stance? What was the relationship before? How did it change? And what's then ending up with, what's the relation between the two? It sounds like there's a, in the person of you, mm-hmm. there's a connection. But yeah, I think it'd be helpful for people to have this explained by you, because I think you're probably one of the best.
If you didn't ask David Baker, you missed the boat on that. However, you have a shot at Dave McCormick. You have a shot at Dave McCormick.
Okay, well, give us yours.
Okay, so so basically, ITRI was an institute underneath the university. Mm-hmm. And there was a decision that a lot of the work was defense-related work. Mm-hmm. And the locus of activity was not in Chicago. It was outside of Washington, D.C., along the Beltway. So there were several different divisions within ITRI. Mm-hmm. And when they made the decision to become independent, with the university's blessing, the only piece of ITRI that was left behind was the biological science piece of it. And I'm sure Dave would correct me in terms of the exact terminology, but and so what happened was the university did several things. It received notes and warrants from the new company in exchange for releasing them. We bought the tower, which was originally designed to be strictly an investment, an asset held in the endowment of the university, and it was to be rental property, and to a large extent was rental property for a while, although I believe never fully occupied. There were always some vacancies within the building. And so what happened was, over a period of time then, the university received money in exchange for those notes and warrants. Okay. At the time of the crash, the ITRI, it's probably mine. Yeah, it's mine. Okay. At the time of the crash, the valuation of those notes and warrants was about $75 million.
All right.
And then it went down, down, down to the point where I believe the lowest point, and there's some discussion of that, mm-hmm. was either, depending on who you talk to, $12 million or zero. Mm-hmm. So it was a big piece of what happened at the university,
okay.
based on the valuation of those notes and warrants that we held.
Okay.
And eventually, the new company, the spinoff, named Alion, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. was able to go out on the capital markets and was able to pay off a percentage of what those notes and warrants had been worth.
All right.
And we received $25 million.
Okay.
So it's one of those, if you think about it, it was an investment.
Mm-hmm.
And for a long time on the books, it was worth a very large amount.
Mm-hmm.
But then economics step in, the crash mm-hmm, happened, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and so to the best of my knowledge, Alion has restructured. They still are very active research, and they still do a lot of defense contracting. Mm-hmm. And then the current ITRI does a lot of biomedical, drug-related research. All right. That's one of their main focuses. Mm-hmm.
Right, well, thank you for that. Yeah.
They own their own building.
Okay.
And we own the tower. They rent space from us as tenants in the tower for their administrative offices.
Okay.
The chair of the Board of Governors is the president of the university. So there's still a great deal of interaction between the two.
Okay.
And David McCormick is a faculty member at IIT.
Okay.
He's a tenured faculty member at IIT. So
that helps.
I can understand why the financial institutions didn't necessarily view ITRE as being completely independent, even though as a legal entity it is independent, because there are a lot of interconnections.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that explanation.
And then the tower became a real resource for us because we were expanding. We needed some space, and we had the ability to be able to take over floors as tenants were moving out. And the last big move out was the headquarters for the Chicago Police and the Chicago Fire Commissioners. And the current administration of the city, as soon as they got in, started looking at all leased space and made the determination that if there was available city-owned property, then they should no longer be leasing space. And that's how those moves happened. It gave us great opportunity, though, because, as you know, main building needed to be closed, and we needed to relocate a number of people. We also needed expansion space for several of our institutes that are in the tower. The business school came back to campus. Rather than renting yet a third property downtown, they came back to campus. And so the tower has afforded us the opportunity to grow and to selectively reconfigure some of the academic units to co-locate them, be able to free up some space for some expansion in engineering and science. So the tower was actually a very valuable resource for us.
Good. Well, thank you for that summary. We'll pull back. Do you have any immediate follow-up?
Well, I'm interested to hear, you know, you obviously played a really core role in kind of some rebounding and some kind of changing trajectory of the university. And I'm wondering what, during your time here, what do you see as your kind of specifically your chief achievements? Like what do you see as what you really brought to the position?
I think for positions, sometimes timing is very important. And one of the big disadvantages of the culture at IIT is how siloed we are. And that functioning as a true full-fledged university becomes a little more difficult. And it's not just geography, because you have institutions that have managed to pull together as an institution and act as one, speak as one institution, even though they have geographical differences. So the biggest thing that I think we needed to do was to be able to appropriately present the fiscal challenges upward to the board, downward to the campus, and outward, because all of those constituents were very important, while at the same time trying to make some headway on this cultural issue of it's not you versus me, it's not us versus them, but we really do have to have some systematic approaches across the whole institution. Now, can I say that in less than 8 short years I've been able to conquer all of that? No. I will not make that claim. But I do think that having had a significant portion of my career in the academic side of the house helped me to understand issues from a very different perspective than you often get from a CFO. And that's very helpful, because I think it enabled us to move a little quicker on some issues than we might have.
Yeah, question. I was very much along the same lines, but you say when you came, of course, in 2009, you had to put out fires, and it was pretty much crisis a day, or you know, many sorts of things like that. At which point, how many years in, was that finally more or less behind you. You might not have known it at the moment, but maybe now in retrospect you might know. And then did it afford an opportunity for you to address some of these, for want of a better term, cultural issues on campus in terms of networking with other the academic units and the other vice presidencies, and in terms of trying to create a dynamic that would help this place act more like a holistic mm-hmm. university?
Mm-hmm. Probably after my first year, maybe a little bit longer, I said that it was going to take the institution at least 10 years to recover. Okay, so I always understood that we were financially fragile. Mm-hmm. And I may have underestimated that, because the economy grew at such a slow pace. There have been lots and lots of challenges that have happened to the city, to the state, mm-hmm. and to the university, and to higher ed in general. So I always thought of it as working towards the long term. And I don't think I ever thought of it as saying, wow, we really turned a corner, although there were milestones.
Okay.
The year that we were able to balance the budget. The next year when we closed and we actually had balanced the budget. I mean, there were lots of different financial milestones that were important. But all along, it was that dual track of trying to also reinforce and foster the culture. Because as long as we were very divided and constantly worrying about how we're cutting up the pie, as opposed to maybe even getting a pie and a half, we'd have problems. And so one of the things that John Anderson said, and Alan and I certainly understood, was that you can't cut your way out of this problem for an institution like this one that had as many financial problems as it did. And that was part of the board's patience with us in supporting us and saying, okay, develop a plan. We'll give you a time frame, but let's develop a plan. And part of that was to grow as well as to strategically make cuts. Because if we didn't grow, we were going to be a very different institution. And so I think as I look out, when I look at our debt, our current debt, and the potential for growth in our endowment, 2020 is probably not a bad year to look at and say, we'll make significant progress by then.
Okay.
Why? Because we're paying down more, a larger chunk of principal each year on our debt. So that number is going down. And hopefully, if we continue to have a strong market like we've had recently, although who knows, you can never bet on the stock market,
yes,
right? Then the endowment will continue to grow. And at some point, we'll be in a very nice ratio. I'm still hopeful that it's 2020. We'll see.
Which isn't all that far away.
It isn't all that far away.
If everything, as you say, projects that way.
That's right. It's not that far away.
Right. So you can leave with that satisfaction.
That's right. That's right. And one of the things I really regret the most about leaving is that there are so many exciting initiatives that are taking place in the next 5 years, and I won't get to be here to see them. Now, yes, I can come back and visit, but it's not the same.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think we have some plans in the work that could be transformational.
Yeah, I wanted to ask, you spoke about the potential you saw in IIT when you arrived, and I was going to ask, what potential do you see now at the time of your departure? What sort of things do you think the university is on the verge of doing or could be kind of looking towards?
The focus on interdisciplinarity, because that's where you make the greatest gains in both significant work and reputation. Okay. We do have some real strengths in terms of our technology focus, but we also have some great strengths in architecture, in law. Now, law has had its particular problems, but I think this institution is uniquely positioned to be able to make the kinds of connections between business, law, design that could enrich our undergraduate and our graduate students. And we're starting to see some of that come to fruition. So if individual faculty can get out of their discipline and work across disciplines with each other, we then offer very unique opportunities to students who then become very successful graduates. And we already see, yes, we graduate small numbers at the undergraduate level. We're not a big institution, but we do very, very well. Our students are very competitive in the job market in things like pay scale and others. And so I think with the demand that we'll have to continue in terms of science and technology going forward, it's never going to be an easy road, but there will be demand there. The unique role that we have within the city of Chicago and within the region, I just see that as great potential for the institution. And the other thing is, I think it's just, it's got some fascinating leadership that are willing to talk to each other and work with each other. And that, as much as anything else, is going to carry us forward. We've recruited fantastic young faculty. And now the challenge is going to be to retain them. The success that we've had with the Research Career Awards and other kinds of programs like that, that's how you continuously get better. You innovate in terms of curriculum, and at the same time, you hire the best and the brightest. And if you can retain the best and the brightest, they'll recruit high-quality students. And then, but you have to start with those foundations. You can't climb the ratings ladder by smoke and mirrors. Very, very difficult to do, because everybody's out there playing that game. So the nice thing about this institution is we're true to ourselves. We talk about the importance of Chicago as a test bed, as a source of support, as a source of students, and then we live it. And we can actually deliver. We actually are successful in getting those students through our programs. That's a great place to be.
As we know with previous interviews, of course, David Baker and Leroy Kennedy and whatnot, how enjoyable on one level and how sort of productive has it been for you to work with the other, you know, those other major areas on campus? In terms of all the things you're addressing, in terms of positioning us as a Chicago institution and interdisciplinary initiatives and whatnot, it obviously
it has been very
certain,
successful.
You have a certain official role here,
right?
But
for me personally, that that's certainly a success. I can speak honestly to my colleagues. We can talk about the pros and cons. It's very respectful discourse. And for the most part, we think of each other when need be and go and talk to them about issues or emerging issues. And that's a very nice place to be, because too often higher ed has, again, even amongst the executive team, too many silos. And so, but that's also a credit to President Anderson and President Cram. That's their style. Their expectation is that their team function by coordinating and communicating. So they set the tone for that. We also have fantastic support from the board. I can't discount how many board members have no educational affiliation with the university, but have recognized the true value of this institution. Sometimes it's for very business-related reasons. They need the types of graduates that we can produce. But that's okay, because they don't have to be at the table. They don't have to contribute their time. And they do.
So it's exciting for them, and it's logical for many of them to make that investment of resource and personal time.
And we're seeing more and more of our alumni come forward and be much more connected with the university. That's a major success of this campaign, in my opinion. And it's necessary, because private institutions need philanthropy to survive. We just do. We have students of need, and we need to help them with their financing. And not all of that can come from their families. Mm-hmm. Not all of it can come from the ability to take out loans.
Right.
And not all of it comes from whatever free sources might be available. So the
yeah.
institution has to have, if we have a commitment,
mm-hmm.
then we have to follow through on it.
That's true, right?
And philanthropy is important.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Because these other resources are stretched.
Yes.
Certainly stretched after these many decades of relying on those, you
mm-hmm.
know, like you say, personal loans or whatnot. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Did you stretch out your time here by a year or two or three, or is this precisely the right time to go? Or?
No, it's actually a very personal decision.
All right.
And I'll actually talk about that.
Yeah.
I was diagnosed with breast cancer
okay.
about a year ago.
All right.
And the prognosis is excellent.
Good.
So I
Good.
Just want to make sure that everybody understands that.
Okay.
But what I do want to talk about is that sometimes it's difficult to put yourself and your family first.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not good at doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And so after I came back from my leave and mm-hmm. treatment, the intense part of it was over. And I just didn't feel that I could give this institution the same amount of energy.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a personal decision.
Okay.
Yeah. I regret very much that I'm in this space, but it is what it is.
Oh,
so,
yeah, right, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, we all have to deal with that.
Yes. And the only reason I want to mention that is mm-hmm. I think we hide those issues.
No, I agree.
I could come up with five different reasons
mm-hmm.
to tell you
Official
why
reasons,
I'm leaving, right?
Structural reasons or whatnot.
Exactly.
No.
But it was the realization mm-hmm. that sometimes you just have to make a selfish decision.
None of us, we don't all live, none of us live forever. And yeah, there are times and a place and seasons.
Yeah.
And that's very important.
Mm-hmm.
As we mentioned to Ruth when she was here, you're speaking not only to answer questions about this institution, but to leave a legacy that perhaps a great-great-grandchild will listen to at some point.
Mm-hmm.
And so being forthright with details like that is it's important.
Well, and I know a lot of individuals, and especially women, who really don't want to talk about it.
Yeah.
But I've had a couple of my younger colleagues who've come forward and said, thank you for talking about it.
Yes.
Thank you
yes.
for making it look normal.
Yeah.
You came back and you look healthy.
Yeah.
You look like you're doing okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so in
yeah.
some ways, I think we do a disservice by trying to keep what turns out to be something that's well beyond our control.
Right.
Quiet.
Right.
Yeah.
And then it becomes more scary.
Right.
Yeah.
It becomes devastating.
Totally agree. Totally agree.
Yeah.
Yeah, we are human beings. We only have the resources of human beings. And like you say, so much is out of our control.
Yeah.
And so we need to just acknowledge that in each other and
mm-hmm.
have that as part of what's known.
That's right.
So thank you for that.
It's interesting to have had the discussion about women in higher education and engineering that we had and to kind of, you know, bring up this topic here towards what I assume is, you know, getting towards the end of our discussion. I think it's an interesting, there's an interesting line to be drawn that I'd like to augment your answer about what you brought to this position, because it sounds like you brought a very strong belief that, you know, people are people, and that all of these names on the org chart or names on the student roster or positions, you know, we're not cogs and we're all human beings. And it sounds like that's something that has been kind of integral to
mm-hmm.
your work in higher education the whole time. And I don't think there's anyone who would disavow that statement, but I think there are people that have more trouble remembering that.
Good way to put it.
You know, you get into a situation too where we use shorthand language that's damaging. So I can sit with a group of administrators in my area
mm-hmm.
and they'll say something about, well, you know, faculty are
mm-hmm.
or you know, students are, and I will bet you if I sat in a faculty group They would say, well, you know, administrators are.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a tendency to dehumanize and not personalize. Yeah, okay, there are stereotypes, that's true. But the reality is we have to deal with each other on a very different level.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that is education. And that's what I've always felt is so important in what I do.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the translator.
Mm-hmm.
There's a regulation. It's ugly.
Yeah.
You don't want to comply with it. But I have to work with you to understand, in some cases, why you don't have a choice to comply with it. But I can tell you maybe an easier way to comply with it. Or in other cases, what you can or cannot do ahead of time to avoid being in that situation. But that's my job. And it's not your job to understand those regulations. It's just your job to understand what you need to do to keep the institution out of risk.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so you're right. I mean, I do think I come at it from a very personal level. Besides which, I'm fascinated with people.
We are too. We are too.
So the work that you're doing is really interesting.
Oh, it is.
Okay.
Yeah, it is. No, we're moving into historical documentation, and yeah, sitting down, and we're not just. We want to see the record creators and speak with the record creators, and not just simply collect records, because records alone can't get you to the final. The final, you know, point of understanding.
That's
oftentimes
true.
They can, but yeah, it certainly helps a great deal too.
Well, and the other thing is, I think interviewing someone like me at this stage of my career, I can tell you things in very different words than I would have been much more careful about talking about, especially some of those issues around gender.
Mm-hmm.
I might not have told you why I was leaving the university 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
First of all, I might be worried about whether or not I'm going to get my next job.
Sure, sure,
mm-hmm.
sure. Right. There's a certain liberation of getting older.
There is, isn't there?
So I have about 10 years to go on. It's amazing how liberating that is, sort of, for me as well.
Well, it's a great opportunity to give back in a way that you couldn't perhaps earlier in your career.
Mm-hmm.
You can mentor individuals on a different level because you're not perceived as being any kind of a threat, any kind of competition, and.
Mm-hmm.
You do have a lot more knowledge and experience.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and you see things with a different lens.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Just mentioned, I think I've mentioned Ruth a few times. There's many similarities. She brought passion to her.
Yeah.
Kind of a quiet passion, but
mm-hmm.
still a passion.
Mm-hmm.
The same sort of thing, trying to speak to some of the bigger issues of humanity and possibility and... So, yeah,
mm-hmm.
at exactly the same sort of moment in
mm-hmm.
her life.
Yeah, and we both lived in interesting times in terms
mm-hmm.
of the,
mm-hmm.
the changing role of women. And when I first applied to college,
mm-hmm.
programs could tell me that they wouldn't accept my application.
Mm-hmm. Huh.
They could just flat out say, we're not taking women.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they didn't usually say it that way,
mm-hmm.
but
mm-hmm.
that was
mm-hmm.
perfectly acceptable.
Yeah, sure,
mm-hmm.
sure. Nowadays, it's sexual minorities or whatnot that can still be told directly that we don't
mm-hmm.
service your particular group or whatnot. But
Well, we're always going to have work to do.
Yes.
But
yes,
universities are one of the most exciting and hopeful environments.
Mm-hmm.
Because we are at the forefront of knowledge.
We're supposed to be.
Yes. We are.
You're right. Yeah.
We are.
Yeah.
But we also have to bring some compassion and some human aspects to what we do as well.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to take care of students.
Mm-hmm.
I love every year when the new students are on campus
mm-hmm.
and their parents hand them over to us.
Mm-hmm.
They're
mm-hmm.
in our care.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's a big responsibility, but
yeah.
it's an exciting opportunity as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think that's something that Alan Cram has attempted to address in his various major speeches and
mm-hmm.
whatnot about that, that we need to grab those human moments when we see a student who's confused or perhaps facing a crisis and not just simply access them as students who bear a certain, programmatic presence, but
mm-hmm.
who are people with needs and oftentimes that very challenged. I wouldn't want to go back to my early 20s, I'll tell you that.
No, and I'll leave you with this. I feel like I've lived a golden life. Not that there haven't been ups and downs,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
but when I look back, there are no major decisions that I would change.
Yeah.
And that is a good place to be.
It is a good place to be. Mm-hmm. It is a good place to be.
It's a really good place to be.
Yeah. We're glad for you. Yeah. We're glad
and
for you.
Thanks so much for making time for us.
Thank
here
you.
In your last few months here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good luck with your project. This is fun.
It is. It is. Yeah. Thanks so much.